Sequoia presents Class of 79.
Raglan, I want my daughter back. Now. Bring her back here? Back to Nola?
No. If they brought her back here, then she'd be up there in the attic. That's where they live.
Thanks for tuning in to Class of 79 on the Fangoria Podcast Network, where we take you behind the scenes of our favorite movies that turned 40 this year. I'm Natasha Pacetta, your host and vanguard of the vault over here at Fangoria, and this is our series on David Cronenberg's The Brood. Our guest today is legendary actor Art Hindle. Art starred as distraught dad Frank in The Brood. Art talks about his transition from successful stockbroker to actor, the horrors of shooting in a real coroner's autopsy room for the film, Oliver Reed's streaking incident, the challenges of bringing Cronenberg's most autobiographical character to life, and much more. Before we get to Art's stories, I want to tell you about the new Fangoria.com. Your homepage for horror is here. Fangoria.com is now live and brimming with the digital horror content you crave. Fangoria.com is your first destination for all the horror news of the day, featuring a constant curation of the Fango team's favorite links from across the internet. They're taking the time to aggregate the most important news in horror in one space to save you time and sanity. Right now, all current subscribers to the magazine are automatically members of Fangoria.com, and as promised, the content of the new issues will forever be print only. If you're not already a subscriber, check out the new Fangoria.com for yourself and see the horror right before your eyes. Use the promo code CLASSOF for 15% off right now at Fangoria.com. And I want to tell you about the Nick Taylor Horror Show. Are you a horror director or an aspiring horror director? Would you like to get free filmmaking advice from some of the latest and greatest names in horror history? Well, you are in luck. The Nick Taylor Horror Show podcast is your go-to masterclass in horror filmmaking, featuring interviews with guests like Joe Dante, Mick Garris, Roger Corman, Tom Holland, Bill Moseley, and Mitzi Perone. Each episode of the Nick Taylor Horror Show explores and deconstructs the success strategies of established horror directors, while summarizing the key insights and resources that you can use on your own horror filmmaking journey. Download and subscribe to the Nick Taylor Horror Show today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere you listen, or visit nicktaylor.com for more information. Now let's get to Art's stories from the making of The Brood. I'm here with Art Hindle, and we're about to talk about David Cronenberg's The Brood. He, of course, was one of the stars as Frank in the movie. But before we get into The Brood, you have been in the entertainment industry for 50 years. You're a true Canadian and American icon. Just your resume is so long. It's unbelievable. But you actually didn't get your start in acting. You didn't start out as an actor. You were a stockbroker. Can you tell us a little bit about how you transitioned from being a stockbroker to an actor?
As a teenager, I'd always wanted to be an actor. I had an uncle who was an actor. I kind of looked up to him and all that stuff. And my mom always thought I should be an actor. But it didn't work out that way. My life took a different turn. I was a bit of a rebel as a teenager and sort of quit school and traveled a lot and hitchhiked around North America. You know, there's a lot of stories about that. But anyway, finally, when I was 19, my girlfriend and I, we had a child. So that kind of changed my life a little bit. And then I had to basically earn a living. And I started out working for CBS Records, but I was working back sort of in the where the stock was. I was keeping the stock and ordering new records and things like that, doing that kind of stuff. And it was kind of a dead end job. And a friend of mine told me about, you know, the money, stock market is really where the money is. So what I did is one day I walked around in Toronto. We have a sort of a Wall Street, only it's called Bay Street. And I walked around and hit up a lot of brokers, just went into their offices and asked if they had a job. And I hit pay dirt. I got a job in an office doing basically it's called a margin clerk, which is really just, you know, you got a pencil in hand and you've got to check accounts all the time. It's a very boring, dull job. And I finally sort of in the business worked my way up. And then I took an exam eventually that got me my stockbroker license, and then I had a client list, and then I started making real bucks, and by servicing my client list, the large client list, and also trading professionally for my broker and everything like that. But I was very unhappy, Natasha, very unhappy, because it was soulless work, let's say. It wasn't making me happy. So long story short, although I sometimes say long story short to a friend of mine, and he says, too late, like as if I go on too long. But I'll try and make it brief. So one night I went to a play, and I was quite moved by the play. And, you know, I actually was moved to tears. And then as I went home that night, I thought, you know, that's really what I want to do. I really want to say important things that make people think, that move people, that make people feel emotional.
Wow.
And I went back the next day after the market closed, and there was a woman there in that same theater. And I said, I want to be an actor, and I'm willing to do anything. So she said, oh, great. Okay. Here's this address. Go to this address, and there'll be somebody there next week, and he'll tell you what to do, but don't wear that $500 suit. So I showed up there, and this guy said, oh, you're the guy who wants to be an actor. I said, yeah, you're going to tell me what to do. He said, yeah, grab a shovel.
What?
And basically, we were going to go into a building that the theater had bought, a building that had been empty for a couple of years. We're going to go in and clean it out and build a theater.
Wow.
So that's how I started.
You got the dirty work, you know.
I got the dirty work. Yeah, I was up to my, fortunately, I had boots on. I was up to my ankles in, there'd been raccoons living in there, et cetera, et cetera. So I won't go into any detail, but it was, that's how I started.
That's such an inspiring story, Art, because you were willing to, you know, stand around and, you know, the aftermath of all these animals and actually bring about this new building for the theater. You were that dedicated to following your real passion or something that made you actually feel like you were doing something of importance. And I think that's such an inspiring story for our listeners to be able to say, hey, I'm not happy in my job. I think I want to go in this direction. And you had the courage to do that, which is amazing. And now, 50 years later, look at you.
Well, if you don't, you know, it was a case of, you know, let's find out, you know, let's find out what's going to happen. You know, some people, you know, wake up 30 years later and regret that they didn't, you know, figure out what would happen sooner than that.
You know? Yeah. And you don't have that. You don't have to look back and say, what if, you know, you did it and it's proved to be a really great decision, I think, for you, because, you know, you are so known in television and movies and, you know, especially, I mean, even the horror genre. This is Fangoria, so of course, you know, we're very interested in horror movies. That's our bag. You know, you were in Black Christmas, your Invasion of the Body Snatchers remake, and then, of course, David Cronenberg's The Brood, which turns 40 this year, which is unbelievable.
Wow. But, you know, compared to my age, The Brood is just a kid.
Yeah.
I'm a little older than The Brood, let's put it that way.
Well, I mean, The Brood is just an amazing work of cinema. Let's start at the audition process for this movie. What was it like? Did you know David Cronenberg before you went into this? Walk us through the beginnings of your involvement in this movie.
Well, you're going to be probably a little disappointed, but there was no audition per se. There was a meeting I had, and you're going to, again, it's going to not be what people thought. So David's a pretty low-key guy, so by that time, I grew up, I lived in Toronto, started my career in Toronto. But by 1978, when we filmed it, the fall of 78, I happened to be in Toronto. I was living in Los Angeles, and I lived there for about 30 years until a few years ago I moved back to Canada.
Oh, wow.
So I lived there for 30 years, but I just been living there in LA since 74. So I'm back in Toronto because my girlfriend was doing a movie at the time, you know, so I'm just hanging out, seeing some old friends, things like that. It was an excuse to be back. And somebody got in touch with me and sent me this script, and I read it and I thought it was pretty crazy, but they said the director wants to meet you. So I went in to meet him, I think at his home. I have to preface our meeting with the fact that David is a speed freak. He loves fast cars, fast motorcycles. And so we sat down and he said, I've got to ask you, is your brother Lang Hindle? Mm-hmm. Now, at that time, Lang Hindle was the top Canadian motorcycle racer.
Oh.
Motorcycles, not overland motorcycles, but kind of track motorcycles that go about 130, 140 miles an hour, 150 miles an hour. And he knew all about my brother. And so he asked me that, if Lang really was my brother. And I said, yes, he is. He said, oh, great. And then he started asking me questions about my brother. And then finally we got around to the film and he said, do you want to do it? And I said, sure. and that was pretty much it. You know, we didn't really even discuss the movie much. I remember one time we were driving home. I was driving him home, as a matter of fact, from a set. And I think my brother had loaned me one of his cars. And so I'm driving him home. We worked all night and it was like early in the morning. And I said, where did you get this story from? Mm. And he said, I got it from my dreams. And I said, why would you dream something like this? And he said, because I'm going through a divorce with my wife and we're fighting over the kids. And that's basically what The Brood is about. If you take all the mumbo jumbo out of it, it's really about a man and wife fighting over the kids.
Yeah, definitely. And it's probably David's most autobiographical film in that sense. And
yes.
I think you have a very important role as Frank Carveth in this movie, because in some sense you must be thinking, well, you know, as the dad in the story, you're kind of a symbol for David. And
that's right.
And
I'm his avatar. I'm his doppelganger.
Yeah, and so that must have been a really great compliment to you for him to pick you to, you know, kind of express like his position of what he was going through. And, you know, it's a movie, you know, and there's psychoplasm.
Yeah, you know,
it's crazy, but
I must tell you, Natasha, I mean, I appreciate what you said there. And I know that might be, you know, like after the fact that, and maybe looking back on it now, maybe I should feel that way. But at the time it was just a lot of hard work, and I didn't know at the time. That was when he told me that when I was driving home early that morning. That was near the end of the film, and he didn't tell me that at the beginning.
Oh.
So I didn't know I was representing David Cronenberg in the film. And in fact, the film was a very, very, very tough film for me to do. And there were more than a few times when I regretted agreeing to do it.
Really?
Well, because, you know, if you look at it, try to put yourself in my place. There's blood and gore and you know, walking fetuses.
Yeah.
And sometimes you sit there on set and you're thinking, I'm doing a film with walking fetuses. I'm doing a film where walking fetuses are in little snow suits walking down the road. I'm doing a film where a little fetus is up in a cupboard about to try and kill me.
Yeah.
You know,
that sounds
so
very ridiculous.
And going back to why I got into the business, if you remember, I wanted to make people cry, but I didn't want to make myself cry. And sometimes on The Brood, on the sets, I was close to tears.
Wow. Is that because you thought, you know, oh, there's like the meaning here is, you know, getting, you know, either lost or you couldn't see like the important message in it at the time, well, when there's all these ridiculous elements happening?
I'm kind of not a horror fan. I'm not a horror fanatic, and I wasn't all then. Right. I know your listeners are going, oh my God, he's not, he's one of us. But, you know, I mean, I appreciate it, and I appreciate the people who love horror films and sci-fi films and all that. And actually, when I was a kid, I was a sci-fi nut. I was a space guy. I was space nut. I used to drag the old boxes of that had refrigerators came in and that were dumped out of my neighborhood. I dragged them into my little back. I had a little side alley on my house, and I'd set up. I'd get a whole bunch of those boxes in a row, and I'd make a spaceship.
Very fun.
Out of these cardboard boxes. And I mean, when I was in grade 4 or 5, I think grade 4 or something, I designed for Halloween and for the class party where they were going to get best costume. I made a robot costume out of cardboard. And I thought, this is with the dials and the face and the little screen in the face and the antenna and the whole thing, I thought I was going to win. And I went home at lunch and put the whole thing on. I had to put everything on. And then I walked to school in it, and it poured rain.
Oh, no.
So by the time I got into the classroom, I was no longer a robot. I was dressed as a blob.
Oh, no.
Of cardboard. It had all kind of melted. And the teacher kind of abided that. And then, you know, sort of halfway through the afternoon, she sent me home because I started to stink, if you've ever smelled wet cardboard.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Not pleasant.
So, you know, it was tragic. I had this tragic childhood. Yeah, I was a sci-fi guy, a sci-fi bug. But, you know, at the time, I was trying to be a serious actor, and I didn't know what. You don't know that, you know, the film's going to someday be a classic, or, you know, it's going to go down in history. You just know that you're from day to day. You know the scene where they're doing the autopsy on the fetus that's been killed?
Oh, yeah.
That was in a real autopsy place in a real hospital.
Oh, ooh, that must have been crazy.
And that was pretty gruesome to begin with. I remember walking over to one of the sinks, and then we had a technician there, and I saw something in the sink, and I said, "What's that?" And he says, "Oh, that's a pair of lungs."
No. Oh, man.
Yeah. And then in another moment, David, we did the thing. Oh, by the way, and the model that came, it's supposed to be the dead fetus lying there. David, I was on the set before he was, and I checked it over, and David walked on, and the guy had made it out of wax. And I said, "David, look at this." And I grabbed it by its feet, by a foot, and I rotated the fake fetus, and the whole thing rotated. It was not like, you know, pliable at all. It was more like, you know,
just
like
too sturdy.
He said, "Oh my God, this is no good." You know, so we actually had to come back the next day or a couple of days later and actually do it again. He had the guy do it over again where it looked more lifelike. So he says, "I don't know, what am I going to do with this?" I said, "Well, you can cut it up into small pieces and sell it as candles."
Yeah.
You know.
Wow.
He thought, he kind of gave me a dirty look there. But, and then, you know, another moment, he says, "Look, why don't we get you coming into this autopsy room? You know, we'll grab a shot while we're here of you walking into it." I said, "Okay." So he says, "Go through that door, shut it, and then I'll give you action, and then you come in." So I waited. I went in there, shut the door, and I'm waiting and waiting, and I don't hear action yet. And I kind of suddenly looked around behind me, and there was 3 or 4gurneys with dead bodies on them.
Real dead bodies?
Yeah, they were going to be going into the autopsy room,
Oh, my gosh.
Huh. You know, their toes are sticking out, and they have tag on it and all that kind of stuff. So,
did you freak
out?
There I was,
thinking, maybe I should have stayed being a stockbroker, you know?
Yeah, I'm sure there are definitely moments when you're surrounded by dead bodies on set where you're like, was this the right decision?
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, and, you know, and then, of course, there's the great ending moment where she reveals her body with all the fetuses growing on it.
And, yeah. Whew. What yeah. Talk about, you know, classic David Cronenberg body horror right there. And that scene in particular has always fascinated me because of your character, Mr. Frank, because the range of emotions that you go through in just that scene is, you know, just I think it would just be so exhausting because you go from, you know, kind of sympathy and like wanting to reconnect with Nola and then her and then being frightened of her and what she's going to do. And then there's the big reveal and then there's just pure fear. And like, that's all like, you know, you had to express all of those emotions throughout that scene. What was that like for you?
It was the way it was kind of technical in a way. That was the problem with it in a way. Mm-hmm. The challenge, I guess, is, you know, this stuff. The film was very low budget, right? So
right.
All these special effects were very iffy if they could be pulled off right. at all. And I think in that case, there was the shot where we got with her, with them, you know, sort of my point of view, that was done well and they were working then. But then when they turn around, it's kind of, and she didn't want to, you know, she wanted to have something across her body when I'm looking at her, right? So I had to imagine what I was seeing, in other words.
So you didn't have that to play off of.
Not really. No. It was a little tricky, you know. But the great thing and the nice thing that worked was my relationship and my how I got along with Cindy, you know, especially for that age. I think she was 9 or 10 at the time, and we're still friends. We're still very close friends. She lives not far from me, and we've done some things. We've done some special things for re-releases of the DVD of The Brood. So
let's talk about Oliver Reed. Working with Oliver Reed, he must have been just a hoot to work with. I've heard some pretty liked to party.
He was a hoot. Yeah, he was a hoot. He liked to party. I went out with him a few times, you know. I had an English friend of mine hired to be my stand-in. He was kind of an actor, model, or entrepreneur guy. So one night before we started filming, we went out with Oliver Reed and Ollie had a cousin over here, and so we went to his house and we were drinking and whatever, and Ollie started looking at my friend's jeans, and he said, "Oh, those look great. They're very expensive, you know." And he was kind of pulling them up and rubbing them between his thumb and his forefinger, and suddenly he said, "Well, how do they cut?" And he took a pair of scissors and cut into them.
Oh my gosh!
My friend's expensive jeans. And my friend said, "What have you done? What have you done to my jeans?"
That wasn't very nice.
"Sorry, here, let me do it with my clothes, my pants, too." And he was cutting his own pants. And
what?
Yes, he was. I remember at the rap party, I was introducing him to my girlfriend's mother, and he had a cigarette in his hand, and he felt he had a drink in one hand and a cigarette in the other hand, and he wanted to shake her hand, so he kind of looked. Cigarette and a drink, and then he put the cigarette in his mouth and chewed it.
What?
And put his hand out and said, "How do you do? Nice to meet you." You know.
Well, I mean, the guy is efficient. I mean.
Yeah. No. And he hit the headlines before he started. He was at a bar right by the hotel, and he bet some guy that he would walk back to the hotel in his underwear.
And he did it.
And he did it.
Wow.
And it was headlines in the newspaper the next day. I think somebody got a photograph. I can't remember, but anyway, that's how we started. And but he was sweet to me and kind to everybody, and he's not never a problem on the set.
Unless you went
into overtime with him.
Oh yeah, well I think that's, you know, any actor will give you trouble on that.
Yeah, some will, some don't. you know, but overtime never bothers me because for me, a set is my Disneyland. It's my happy place.
That's so awesome. And
I have a reputation for even showing up on a set when I'm not working.
See, that's the kind of actor I like to see. I like to see the ones who, you know, when they don't have to be there, they still show up to show support and, you know, are there if anyone needs anything. And
I advise young actors to do that when they're hired for a movie or whatever they're going to do. If they have an opportunity to visit the set before they work, I tell them it will pay off because you can get to know the crew and you can get to watch the director, how he works. You can get to know the cinematographer, the camera crew, and how they work. And you can become friends with people. So that when you do come on the set, you're not with a bunch of strangers and you're not going to get overly nervous. You know, I always get nervous on a set anyway, no matter what, first day, especially. There's always a little bit of nervous tension, you know.
And that's a good thing. That means, you know,
you're
excited.
Keeps you alert.
Keeps you alert. Well, I think that's a testament to, you know, you as an actor, Art. I mean, you've been in this industry for 50 years and have worked, you know, so consistently. Are you working on anything right now that you can talk about?
Actually, I did a kind of a horror film. Maybe you've heard about it a couple of years ago called The Void.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I was in that briefly. It was kind of funny being, I don't know if you've seen it, but it's kind of a monster who takes over people's bodies and has tentacles.
Yeah. Yeah, wow. And I didn't realize you were in that. That's awesome.
Yeah, and I had a hilarious moment. I almost wish they were, you know, filming like an on-set kind of thing because this monster has me in its grip with its tentacles. So you've got the fake monster with the person inside it, the technician, and you've got these tentacles sort of placed around me. And him and I are face to face, like about as intimate as you can get without kissing. And he's inside this monster and I'm having a coffee. So we're talking and as they set up the lights and everything like that. And then I put my coffee down and then the director says action. And then I start screaming and wriggling around and everything, doing all the histrionics. And then they cut. And then I stop and somebody hands me my coffee back again. And we continue to chat. It's, you know, the behind the scenes of these things that people don't see that is sometimes the most entertaining, you know?
Oh, of course. I would have loved to have seen that.
I always tell people, and, you know, I'm sure this is written across the internet, me quoting me saying this, but I always tell people that David is a very low-key director, gives very little advice to his actors on the set, doesn't do a lot of directing per se. Basically, you know, it's all there in the script. The one direction I did hear him say a lot was when he'd look at a scene and they'd say, "What do you think, David?" And he'd say, "More blood." It needs more blood, whether it was on my jacket or on Cindy or on Ollie or on the set or on the dead body or on whatever, you know?
Hey, that's our motto around here at Fangoria too. More blood.
Yeah. More blood. I gave him a t-shirt. I don't know if he still has it. Back in those days, it was a little more difficult to have a special t-shirt printed, but I found a place and I had the t-shirt with the across there. It said more blood and the blood's dripping off the letters, you know?
Oh, cool. Wow. Yeah. Well, that's Cronenberg for you. More blood.
Yeah.
I have one more question for you, and it's our extra credit question that I ask all of our guests, and that's if you could go back in time 40 years ago, what advice would you give yourself?
I would probably say save your money and take lots of photos of your character.
Yeah.
Because I find when I go to some of these, when people want photographs and autographs and all that kind of stuff, it's hard for me to find good photographs of myself in characters, different characters, because I never really concentrated or focused on that, you know? And of course, I had 5 kids, so it was very difficult for me to save money. I probably could have, but I was, you know, it, the money when I was younger came fast and loose, you know. It was funny after, you know, at the end of The Brood, I'll tell you one story. At the end of The Brood, I was pretty depressed. It was fall, late fall, early winter in Toronto, and it was cold and miserable, and I don't like winter. I don't like cold and miserable, although I'm back here living in it, and I love it now because I'm in love and I'm happy. But I was miserable. My girlfriend had finished her film and gone back to L.A. We weren't having a good time over the phone. We were getting in arguments and all that kind of thing. Eventually, we broke up a couple months later, and but Invasion of the Body Snatchers opened that Christmas of 78, and I went to see the film at a local theater, and it was fabulous, and it cheered me up immensely. It just made it made me great. I could make it to the end of the week, end of the film. Brood was almost finishing, and so it buoyed me up, and I was good to go for another week or so.
That's great. You know, one thing, I know I'm always depressed after something like a fun project ends, and then it's like, oh, well, you know, what is there? But that's great. Wow. Back to back. You filmed The Brood and
doing the film. And then I was happy when I finished it. I hate to tell you this. I mean, it's because it has become a classic, and I do understand that. And I do understand why people appreciate it. And I do understand David's, you know, genius, and because the proof is in seeing all these fabulous films he's done. But, you know, coming from where I was coming from, it was hard to see.
You are truly an icon, and I can't thank you enough for spending some time with me to chat about your career and David Cronenberg's The Brood for its 40th anniversary this year. Art, thank you so much. You were an amazing guest, and I hope to stay in touch with you.
Well, thanks, Natasha, anytime, and thanks for asking me, and all the best to you and your listeners.
Are you ready for me, Frank? Are you really? I seem to be a very special person. I'm in the middle of a strange adventure.
Let me be with you. I want to go with you wherever you go.
Do you? Do you?
Yes.
Thanks for listening to Fangoria Presents Class of 79. We really appreciate you tuning in. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, we'd love it if you would rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes or on your favorite podcast app. And follow Fangoria on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for the horror content you crave. Class of 79 is a Fangoria Podcast Network original, produced and hosted by Natasha Pasetta, executive producers Dallas Sonier and Phil Nobile Jr., associate producer Jessica Safavamer, art and design by Ashley Detmering, sound recording, design, and mixing by Natasha Pasetta, music by James Malone, for Fangoria, Brandon Wynerdy, Jason Koslerich, Rachel Wilson, and special thanks to Udo Kier.